Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. This week at the Florida Phoenix, Craig is the author of a very hard-hitting, no punches pulled, bare knuckles examination of the state's failure to protect manatees.
Yeah, I'm pointing out that, you know, the legislative session that just ended was really big on cultural and social issues. You know, they banned abortion after 15 weeks, even in cases of rape and incest. They passed this law that says you can't talk about past racism in a way that makes white people uncomfortable, basically, you know, stuff like that. And then they left out, you know, they failed to do anything about our insurance crisis, our affordable housing crisis. They didn't do anything about the Surfside condominium collapse. But to me, the biggest thing they skipped was they didn't do anything at all about the pollution that's been flowing into the Indian River Lagoon, killing the seagrass and killing the manatees. Mm-hmm. We had 1,000 manatees killed last year, and they're dying again this year. We've had about 400 die so far this year from the same cause. They're starving to death, and they spent some money on manatee rehab and manatee rescue, but nothing about the pollution, which is the base cause of all this. And it just drives me bonkers that they're not even talking about it.
Right. And it reminds of the legislature's policy towards climate change, where they're going to throw all sorts of money at the after effects and resiliency and trying to mitigate the effects without doing anything to address the cause.
Yeah, exactly.
We know definitively, with great certainty, what the cause of the manatee deaths are. It is from starving. They are starving because their seagrass beds have died. Their seagrass beds are dying because of algae blooms choking the seagrass beds off from sunlight, which they need to obviously photosynthesize. And those algae blooms are fueled by runoff, toxic runoff, agricultural, septic, industrial roads. None of that was addressed.
No. And it's all because they're getting campaign contributions from the people who are doing the polluting, and they don't want to rock that boat, pardon pun. And so they would much rather have manatees die than, you know, cut off the source of their funding. So I called them out, and I said this every campaign forum that DeSantis shows up for his reelection campaign, every campaign forum that Senate President Wilton Simpson shows up for, because he's running for agriculture commissioner, people should ask, what are you doing? Why didn't you do anything? Why are you willing to allow manatees to die?
Well, and again, they're going to point to all this money. And it's you made this analogy before, and it's a good one that I had thought of. It's the absentee parent who buys their kid a new car. And that's great parenting. Right. No, great parenting is time, and it's concern. And why are all these manatees dying? Because the Florida legislature does not care. Don't confuse this. All of the solutions are readily available to stop this problem. The legislature doesn't care enough to do anything about the manatees. They would rather side with Big Ag, with developers, and with the growth that is killing the wild animals of this state.
Right. And it's not just an environmental crisis. It's an economic crisis, because
it will be.
Dead manatees equal bad tourism industry, bad fishing. All of those things are affected by it.
Yeah.
And those are economic factors as well.
There are health factors, as you point out in your article about the quality of air, drinking water. This is going to be a problem that will come home to roost beyond the manatees someday. And we'll all wonder, well, why didn't we do anything about it in the early 2020s? Craig's latest column, FloridaPhoenix.com. Really spot on, and it is a body blow to the state legislature for its inaction where it's needed most and its action on where it's needed least. This episode of Welcome to Florida is brought to you by Visit Sarasota. Hey, Palmer Point Beach Park, if you are looking for one of those best kept secret kind of places, one of those feel like you're a million miles away from anyone else, Palmer Point Beach Park may be Sarasota's best kept secret. Now, for centuries, Midnight Pass separated Siesta and Casey Keys, but in 1984, the pass began to migrate and threaten beachfront homes. So the county allowed homeowners to close the pass and relocate the waters. And in doing so, Palmer Point Beach was born. You can walk there from Turtle Beach, although you may need to wade in places. Most people get there by kayak, motorboat, paddle boards, or from the bayside. You will walk onto that dune and feel like you've traveled back in time. This is Robinson Crusoe here. You've got expansive views of sea and sand and sky, not a condo in sight, and many days, no other people. Beautiful place to watch a sunset, take a picnic, go for a swim. There's no lifeguard, so be careful. But if you are looking for one of those remote beach experiences that you thought only maybe existed in the Keys or in the Caribbean, Palmer Point Beach Park, visit Sarasota.com. Now, that takes us to this week's guest and the very recently retired Florida Supreme Court Director of Communications, Craig Waters. An old chum of Craig's from back in the day.
We are both from Pensacola, and we're both named Craig, and we both wound up working at the Pensacola News Journal. He was actually my mentor there, kind of showing me the ropes. He had preceded me covering county commission there. He was Craig one and I was Craig two. And then there was a Craig three who worked over in our Santa Rosa County Bureau. I'm not sure whatever happened to him, but obviously Craig Waters was covering legal beat, covering courts. And I remember very distinctly him coming back in the newsroom one day and I asked, how did it go? And he said, those lawyers made such a dumb argument. I thought to myself, you know, if I went to law school, I could do that. I could do that better than they can. And the next thing I know, he's the public spokesman for the Florida Supreme Court. So that worked out pretty well.
Speaking to the media on behalf of the court in some of the most high profile cases in American history. And that's what we're going to talk about next with Craig Waters.
Craig, I know the answer to this question, but tell our audience how your journalism career led you into working for the Florida Supreme Court.
Well, that goes back to Gannett and USA Today. Craig, of course, I first met you at the Pensacola News Journal when we both were working there in the early 1980s. And I had gotten myself loaned out to the Gannett News Service here in Tallahassee when they were just starting USA Today and were short of staff around. So they brought me over here, and I thought I was going to be doing some grand and glorious work covering the legislature and state government and the Supreme Court, where I now work. And I got over here and found that I was being hijacked all the time to write three to six paragraph stories for USA Today. So not being terribly happy with that, I decided to take the law school admission test and did well enough to get into just about any place in the Southeast. And so that was, you know, me going off to do something different than working for USA Today.
So you became a lawyer and you did a clerkship. Was that it for the first female Supreme Court Chief Justice?
Right. I was hired right out of law school by Justice Rosemary Barquette, who was the first woman ever appointed to the Supreme Court. And that was, you know, something of a plum job, you know, coming right out of law school, because there aren't many of these jobs and lots of lawyers like them to, you know, to build a resume, build credentials, because it's considered to be prestigious if you can go later on and practice law and tell your clients you worked at the Supreme Court at one time. So right. I came here thinking I would work here for 2 years and then I would go back to Miami and work with Parker Thompson's law firm, where I had done clerkships when I was in law school. Parker Thompson, of course, was one of the premier First Amendment lawyers in Florida at that particular point in time. And, you know, and that was a good assignment as well. I thought I was going to do that. But when I got to the end of the 2 years with Rosemary Barquette, things weren't working out very well for Parker Thompson's law firm. They were having some issues. Of course, media law was not quite in, or the news media, I should say, was not quite in the straits it's in today. But there were some signs that was on its way. Because of all these uncertainties, I had come back from an interview with this firm, and Justice Kogan stopped me in the hallway and just out of the blue asked me if I'd work for him for 2 more years. And I said yes, because I was concerned about going into law at that particular point in time. And then within 2 years or a little over 2 years of that, Justice Kogan was chosen as Chief Justice-elect. And then he asked me if I would stay to be part of his administration because he had some plans of things he wanted to do in the area of openness and transparency. That's how I ended up as the court's first communications director.
Interesting. All right. So that sort of opens the door for asking. The Florida Supreme Court had just come through a massive scandal. That's sort of what led to this concern about transparency. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's very true.
And bear in mind, we only have 30 minutes.
I could spend days talking about the scandal. When I first arrived at the court in 1987, we were more than 10 years past the scandal at that point in time, but it still lingered over everything. It was a horrible scandal back in the mid-1970s involving four of the seven justices who were allegedly taking kickbacks in order to fix cases or throw cases or whatever. You know, there were.
And it was tied to the dog racing industry, wasn't it?
It was tied to regulated industries, and mm-hmm. dog racing was one of them. There were also some concerns about utility companies also joining in this payola bandwagon, this graft bandwagon. Mm-hmm. We even had one of the justices at the time who supposedly got an opinion written in advance by one of the utility companies in that utility company's case.
Yikes.
This justice made the famous statement when he was being investigated for impeachment that he had taken the draft opinion, torn it into 17 equal pieces and flushed it down the toilet. Well, if you've ever tried to tear anything into 17 equal pieces, it doesn't work.
Math was not his strong suit.
You know, a lot of us went to law school for the same reason.
Yeah. How was this scandal uncovered?
It was really uncovered because of the work of a journalist named Martin Dyckman, who I have known for a long time now. He's retired now, but he still does some writing. And I've had a chance to talk with Martin at great length over the years about this. What happened is that there were some young staff attorneys who were working at the Florida Supreme Court at the time who had seen evidence of the corruption that was going on. And one of them had actually gone to Martin Dyckman. Martin kept his name confidential, of course, and did so. Martin has never told me the name, but this young attorney gave Martin the material that Martin needed to uncover the story. But later on, there was an attorney who was not just fired from the Florida Supreme Court and all of this, apparently because there were suspicions that he was the leak. But he was also summoned before the court in open session and publicly reprimanded, which is a very unusual measure and something that would be a big problem in any career. So the Florida Supreme Court at that time had taken this very seriously, and really I think made their own situation worse by trying to punish this particular attorney.
Yeah, didn't one of the justices wind up going on the lam for a while?
Yeah, that was Justice McCain. Mm-hmm. Justice McCain was one of the ones who was investigated for impeachment. He ended up resigning and then kind of wandered around for a while and apparently got involved in some alleged drug smuggling.
This is such a Florida story.
The only thing we need more is Cuban gun running, I guess.
And naked people.
But Justice McCain was on the lam on these drug issues at the time he died, and was found deceased before the law enforcement caught up with him. Of course, there were three other justices involved. One of them actually managed to escape impeachment after he agreed to undergo a psychiatric exam. And passed it. And for years,
so after you had to prove you were sane in order to avoid being impeached.
For years after that, he would tell everybody that he was the only justice on the Supreme Court that could prove his sanity.
So, were any of them actually impeached? Were they removed from office, or did they resign? Or
except for that one justice, they resigned rather than go through the impeachment process.
Wow!
I can tell you though, when I first came here, there were staff that had been here when all of that was happening. One was our clerk of court at the time, Sid White. Sid was the closest thing to a public information officer, communications director that they had back then. And that, that was not considered to be a primary duty by any means. But Sid was the one who ended up having to deal with the press. And, mm-hmm. and because he was dealing with the press, Sid also got dragged before the impeachment committee in the legislature to testify under oath, which was an extremely difficult situation to be in.
Right.
When the majority of the court that he, you know, had to respond to and had to answer to was being investigated by the same committee.
Hmm. But how did this scandal result in changing the court and as a piece of that, your ultimate hiring?
Well, Reuben Askew from Pensacola was the governor at the time, and he was horrified by what he saw going on at the Supreme Court. And they took a good look at the Florida Constitution. The provisions that laid out how the Florida Supreme Court would work had been adopted in the Reconstruction era after the Civil War. And they were really designed for an agricultural state, a small agricultural state, which Florida was back then. Of course, after World War II, Florida ceased being that completely. Right. Askew decided to put together some groups to propose constitutional revisions. There were a series of revisions that started in the mid-1970s and continued through 1980. They began to change the way justices were selected. They did away with contested races for elections, which had certainly contributed to the graft that was going on, because the special interest also were the people who had cases pending before the court, and they were the ones who were contributing the most to these justices. Mm-hmm. So they eliminated that and started a merit retention system where justices would be chosen from a nominating commission list by the governor. The hope was that would remove politics from that process. And some other structural reforms were changed. The jurisdiction of the Florida Supreme Court was limited to try to stop some of these relatively minor cases that happened to involve narrow interests of companies that were willing to kick a lot of money toward the Supreme Court justices if they would favor them. So the jurisdictional changes also were aimed at limiting the temptation, shall we say.
So you were hired basically to try and make things more open and accessible to the press.
Well, when I started in 1987, Justice Barquette was the first one of the reformers who really started things going in a big way in the 1990s when they started to become Chief Justice. I, of course, was working for Barquette at the time.
A former nun, right?
She's a former nun. Wow. I can tell you there were many times when I was waiting for my knuckles to get wrapped by that ruler because she looked like she was ready to do it. She was had a very good sense of how government should work, and she certainly was not in it for the money. She was one of the reformers that came in the 1990s. Leander Shaw was another. And of course, my boss in the 1990s was Justice Gerald Kogan, who was the one who decided that he wanted to take the issue of openness and transparency and make that a primary focus of his administration. The idea being that this would eliminate to quote Justice Brandeis, it would have brought in some sunshine with the idea that sunshine is a great disinfectant.
Sure.
Justice Kogan often quoted that to me and told me that what he wanted me to do was to create that sunshine, to set up systems whereby transparency and openness became a big part of what the court was doing. And of course, that also coincided with the time when the World Wide Web was first coming into existence, something that I had gotten into and was exploring before there was anyone really to teach you how to do it. Justice Kogan and I focused very early on using these new high-tech approaches to increase transparency. So, the World Wide Web was certainly one way of doing that. And in quick order,
posting things online and so forth. Yeah.
Right. We were posting, court filings online, especially in high profile cases. And by 1997, we were broadcasting oral arguments from start to finish on the World Wide Web and thereby making it available on a worldwide basis, mm-hmm. although at that time, bandwidth was still something of a problem.
You were obviously there for a lot of huge cases, none more so, I would imagine, than the 2000 election and the recount. What do you remember of that time? And was that the most heavily pressed and stressed you were for information from the media?
Well, it was pretty stressful for 36 days. Florida had this election and then totally botched it. And no one knew exactly which candidate had won Florida's vote. And Florida's vote was going to determine the outcome. Of course, that was between Al Gore and George W. Bush. When it first hit, that November 7th, 2000, I was away in Orlando at a conference of court communications staff giving a lecture on how to use the internet to improve public access. Little did I know I was going to go back home and to a big assignment of my own. And in fact, I had to leave the conference early because Chief Justice Charlie Wells at the time had his secretary call me up the morning after the election and said, "Get back here right now." and of course, you know, the first issue were the butterfly ballots, which looked like it was something that was going to stay in, you know, in the federal courts, or so we hoped. Didn't turn out that way, of course. So, you know, I went driving back to Tallahassee very early in the morning, the day after the election, you know, kind of wondering what was going on and thinking, well, you know, I'll be there and I'll be ready. Actually, the first thing I did when I got back was create a new webpage just for Bush v. Gore cases. To tell you how trusting I was, I even put my cell phone number on it. And totally forgot that I had done that. And then later on in the controversy, I was wondering why everybody seemed to have my cell phone number.
Might have been a little too much transparency.
That was when I realized that the personal information really didn't need to go up there on the webpage. But I, you know, I got back, and you know, for about 7 days, it looked like the controversy might either blow away or it would be resolved in some boring case in federal court. But I kind of got a little nervous on November 14th when I looked out the window at the Florida Supreme Court where I work, and I saw that a vendor had set up a little stand outside my window.
Yeah, that's a bad sign.
He was selling T-shirts. And the T-shirt said, "Stop Electile Dysfunction." That was when I knew we were really in trouble.
Now, you, if I remember right, you wound up getting a personal scar while this was roiling the courts.
I did. I was talking on my cell phone while I was driving because, you know, I was trying to schedule so many things with these different, you know, high profile media personalities who were in town. I was rushing to get to an interview with Bill Hemmer, who was with CNN at the time, and getting out of my car, my car doors, I pushed it too hard. It came back and bopped me in the side of the head and left a nice big ugly gash. That I then had to commandeer someone from the Florida Channel TV network to come over and hide with makeup. it would have made a very nice, you know, Frankenstein kind of Halloween thing. Apparently it was not something I wanted to be broadcasting on worldwide television.
Yeah.
I imagine not. Somehow they skipped that in the TV movie, I think.
Yeah, they did. They did skip that in the HBO movie.
Aside from not posting your personal cell phone on the internet, what did you learn about how better to do your job through that crisis?
Well, the great thing about that particular episode was that it proved the wisdom of what Justice Kogan had asked me to do. I set out at the beginning of Bush v. Gore to make sure there was as much transparency as I could create. You know, and keep in mind, this was still a time when people were not that accustomed to using the World Wide Web.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when there were very few courts on a worldwide basis that were using using the World Wide Web the way we were. For 4 years at that point, we had been posting documents in PDF up on our website, including filings in the high profile cases. For 3 years, we had been live streaming on the web, you know, all of our oral arguments. So we had 3 years experience doing that. And, you know, I can tell you, you know, we had, you know, international press corps show up outside my doors in Tallahassee, several hundred of them at the high points. And, you know, they were amazed at this, you know, crazy place called Florida and this weird little capital city called Tallahassee that was almost in Georgia. Several of them, I remember distinctly, you know, when I would go out to meet them, told me that I would be getting a demand letter from their attorneys in Manhattan. And I did. I got several attorney demand letters. Demanding access to documents, demanding access demanding ability to set up television cameras in our courtroom. And so there I was trying to explain to these lawyers that we already had all of that up on the web. And they didn't believe me. They could not imagine a court that was doing that.
Especially in Podunk, Florida. Yeah.
Especially in Podunk, Florida. I honestly had to bring in these, you know, these media personalities and TV crews into the courtroom to show them our cameras to prove that we were actually doing this. And they were still so nervous. It was amazing that, you know, the night before the first oral arguments at the court, I had the five big TV news networks at the time, the worldwide news networks, who had come into the court, and they looked scared to death. And one of them even told me, you know, she said, you don't understand, if your broadcast from these little tiny cameras in your courtroom don't work, I'm going to be fired tomorrow. And and so, you know, we did get the feed up, and we ran a test before, which seemed to placate everybody. And, you know, by the time the oral arguments began in the morning, we were streaming to a worldwide audience on the web. We also had we had access to the state satellite transponder, so we had that available, and that could be downlinked anywhere in North America. And of course, all the pleadings that were coming in the cases were already up on our website in PDF. But even then, I sat a lot of reporters who still insisted on doing things the old way. You know, it was really amazing. I could not get these reporters to look at the website, especially to get the PDF documents of filings that were coming in. That continued up until one night after the first oral arguments. We had several hundred reporters that were outside the building. They were waiting for us to release what was really sort of a minor order, responding to some of the pleadings, and they thought it was a big deal. And so they were waiting, and our big, gigantic, high volume photocopier crashed and burned. We had worn that baby completely out.
Wow.
And so, you know, I was out there talking to these reporters, and I kept saying, "You don't understand. It's on our website. It's on our website." And they'd look at me like I was crazy.
Yeah, because they'd rather have a 4-inch stack of paper that they could, you know, flip through. It was just it's a different
era.
Time and place. Yeah, it's crazy. And I just imagine that scene of hundreds of reporters, New York, London, all over the world, Associated Press, New York Times. I mean, name the outlet. And here they are, like you said, 36. I mean, they're in Tallahassee for a month. It's the biggest news story ever. I mean, a contested American presidential election comes down. It's hard to go back in time. Obviously, you lived it point blank. But even you know, for myself or Craig, to think back about how big of a deal that was.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I think we're a little more jaded because the world is different now than it was back then. But, you know, the presidency of the United States was at stake. Florida's votes was uncertain, and to this day, there's still uncertainties about how that election came out. This was not just grand drama; it was also an event that was going to change history worldwide.
Yeah. Well, and in hindsight, the difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush, Iraq War, climate change, Afghanistan—I mean, that if someone wanted—and I'm sure this has been done—but you talk about coming to a fork in the road for a country and the world. Right. That is a pretty big one.
Right. And even some of the legal theories that came out of those cases are still kind of bumping around and haunting us today.
Really?
And so it changed the legal landscape as well.
Give us an example.
Yeah.
Well, this idea of lawyers call it the unitary legislature theory. That's a grand name for an idea that really originated in one of Justice Rehnquist's separate opinions in the Bush v. Gore cases. Rehnquist argued, he did not get a majority of the vote, but he argued that the Florida Supreme Court had intruded into an area that was exclusively reserved to the Florida legislature, and it was reserved not by the Florida Constitution, but by the U.S. Constitution. That was based on some somewhat vague language in the U.S. Constitution. But the idea is basically, you know, with this unitary legislature theory, that the legislature of a state gets to decide exactly how presidential elections will be conducted, and that the other branches of government in that state cannot interfere with that process, even if it's a part of a normal judicial review process. Now, obviously, Rehnquist did not get a majority of the vote back then, but that theory is still, you still hear echoes of it today. And it certainly came up during the last presidential election when there was some concern that one or more states might do what Florida did in 2000 and mess up their election.
Once the election was over and everybody left, did things seem abnormally quiet once once that was over.
Well, it was really weird. Although, you know, by that point, my face had become such a household thing that it was a problem. And I really, in the middle of it, I didn't realize that that was happening. You don't realize it till you get out in the real world and see the results. The craziest moment I had after it was over was that I went home for Christmas. Christmas came not too long after it all ended.
Yeah.
And I was over visiting my mother in Beulah, Florida, and my sister. And my mother decided she wanted to go to the outlet mall in Foley, Alabama. And so I drove her over there. My sister came along as well. And we got into one of the stores. Well, I hate shopping. So I was standing over in a corner somewhere, minding my own business and just kind of looking around, waiting for my mother and my sister to get through. When I looked up at one point at the plate glass window at the front of the store, there was a mob forming at the plate glass window. And I'm looking there, and I was thinking, why is there a mob forming? Because they were pointing and staring. And, you know, I kept looking over my shoulder to see what they were pointing and staring at. And finally, the manager of the store came up to me and told me that he was afraid that I was going to have to leave through the back door. And by then I realized that I was probably not in a good place. But it was very interesting how that whole thing ended, because there was a gentleman at the store who was with his wife, and he didn't like shopping either. And he walked up to me and shook my hand and identified himself as the Republican chair of the county commission in Baldwin County, Alabama. And he just chatted with me a little bit, shook my hand, patted me on the shoulder, and walked away. And that little display of a handshake seemed to calm down the mob. And I actually was able to leave through the front door.
Oh, man. How strange. What were those people wanting to do or want to do with you?
Well, this was George W. Bush country, and I had been the spokesman for a court that had been ruling in the way Al Gore wanted.
Until it ultimately mattered the most, however, though. I mean, that side ultimately won. And let's not overlook the reality that you were just the messenger.
That message got lost early. I realized that early on, or you know, shortly after I started making the television appearances, I started getting a lot of really weird email and voicemail messages. And it was clear from these people that they thought I was the one making the decisions and then walking out on the front steps and announcing it to the world.
You were the secret genius behind it all, pulling the strings.
Right. It was truly strange. And in fact, it got so crazy that our marshal ended up assigning a security officer to me, an armed security officer to me, every time I went out of the building. That continued for a while. They even arranged for sheriff's deputies to park outside my home just in case someone found out where I lived.
Yeah.
No one ever did. I didn't have any incidents at my home. Yeah. It was a truly weird feeling of you know, suddenly becoming the face of the Supreme Court. Yeah. And of course, my bosses, the justices, were quite happy with that because they were not targeted. You know, we had even kind of developed a routine early on when I would make the big decisions. I would give 30 minutes notice to the networks that I was about to announce a decision in a case.
You mean when they made the big decision?
And exactly.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But anyway, I would go out and announce what the court had done after this 30-minute gap. Well, you know, during that 30 minutes, the justices would get in their cars and leave the building and drive home while all the attention was focused at the front of the building and the podium that had been set up for me. So it was a clever way for them to avoid being chased down the streets. Of course, that didn't really help things with me.
Yeah, you were the scapegoat. They
amazing,
staked you out
amazing.
For the
which I'm sure gives you, you know, that experience, and especially what the internet is now and what the political discourse is now, gives you tremendous empathy for these election officials across the country following our most recent presidential election, Georgia, Arizona, almost everywhere, which saw them being threatened physically as almost a matter of course.
Yeah, and you know, that was at a time, that was before the terrorist attacks that happened in 2001, which really changed the way the public perceived events like this. You know, we became a less trusting society, a society more concerned about violence after the 9/11 attacks. you know, but I certainly had a lot of sympathy when I was seeing what some of these election officials and others were going through last time when they were thrust into the media spotlight. I never realized exactly how quickly that could happen and how intrusive it could be until it happened to me.
Obviously, this was the most controversial thing that you've ever been involved with, but the court is no stranger to controversial cases. I mean, death penalty cases, they make up what, about 40% of what the justices have to deal with?
I would probably say more around 60%. And that's because the Supreme Court has mandatory jurisdiction, and you know it has to hear the cases. And death penalty cases produce a huge number of appeals and separate proceedings that are called collateral reviews. All of these have to be addressed by the Florida Supreme Court. You can't just bounce it down to a lower court. You know, it's a very complex area of law. You know, also generates a lot of crazy feelings. You know, we've certainly seen some death penalty cases that produced something not quite like Bush v. Gore, but, you know, approximating some of its aspects. You know, the Paul Hill case from Pensacola, the guy who killed the abortion doctor over in Pensacola, that really got a lot of inflammatory attention. You know, there were a lot of threats that were going around.
He argued that he did it to save the babies, right?
He was arguing defense of others. And so, you know, that was going on. But there were a lot of people who thought he was something like John Brown before the Civil War.
Yikes.
At one point, I got a threatening letter that was mailed to me that had a bullet in the envelope. I never saw it. That Marshall intercepted it before it ever reached my office. But that was the first time that I actually got a bona fide threat.
Wow.
And of course, that happened, even before the Bush v. Gore cases.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, what were they thinking that you were somehow to blame for him making a bad defense?
I spent a long time trying to figure that out and realized that was another case where I had been a little too open with a website I created, because we had a separate death warrants webpage back then. And I had put my name and my office on it. So we think that's where they got the address from, along with my name.
Yeah, yeah. If I had to guess at what would play second place to the 2000 election, and I don't even know if these made it to the Florida Supreme Court, but I would say Elian Gonzalez and Terry Schiavo would be other prominent ones that might have approximated that hysteria.
Well, the Elian case, of course, was mainly a federal case, although it did impact us in some ways. I had to accompany the Chief Justice down to Miami for a ceremonial event while Elian was going on. It was a ceremonial event that was where my boss at the time, the Chief Justice Major Harding, was going to be speaking on the same stage with Janet Reno, who was the Attorney General at the time.
Yeah.
And of course, Janet Reno had taken a very vocal position along with the Justice Department in the Elian Gonzalez case. And you know, when we got down to this event in Miami, I was following the Chief Justice, and it looked like they had an army division surrounding that building. Janet Reno showed up in this this limousine that was being accompanied by a huge police motorcade. You know, I was in there. I was trying to help with press matters because there was quite a press corps there. Mm-hmm. The strangest moment with me, though, was when we left that event. I was leaving with the Chief Justice. And we got into our car, and we were told that we had to get into Janet Reno's motorcade to leave this venue. And so I get in the car, and I had just buckled my seat when all of a sudden the policeman who was driving that car slammed the accelerator to the floor, and we took off like a rocket with Janet Reno's limousine in front of us. And here we are completely surrounded by these police cars with blue lights on, sirens screaming. And I there was one moment when I looked through the back window, and there were mobs climbing over barricades to chase us down the street.
Wow.
It looked like something from a banana republic.
Nice. Now, did the Terry Schiavo case make it to the Florida Supreme Court?
The Schiavo case made it to the Florida Supreme Court many times, even before the big cases came in the 2004-2005 period. At the point when we were, when it was reaching its zenith, there were six cases that came to the Florida Supreme Court. And all of these had to be dealt with fairly quickly because there were time-sensitive matters.
Yeah.
And of course, by that point, Governor Jeb Bush was involved. Mm-hmm. Soon his brother, President George W. Bush, also was involved, and Congress was involved.
Yeah.
So it started to become extremely complicated. You know, there was even a point one time when, there were a lot of appearances that the governor might send in Florida Highway Patrol or some other entity to seize control of Mrs. Schiavo, to remove her from the facility where she was being kept. And so, you know, that posed a serious issue of the division of powers, because court cases had already resolved the matters by that point mm-hmm. in time. And for a governor to intervene would have been an obvious violation of court orders. Fortunately, we never reached the point where we had that kind of constitutional crisis. Governor Bush backed off, and the Florida Supreme Court never had to deal with the question that seemed to be coming toward us, which was holding a governor in contempt of court.
Wow.
Amazing stories. And it's surprising. All of those happened within like a couple of years. I mean, those were not like distant by 8-10 years. I mean, it's like one after the, I'm sure at some point you get this what next mentality.
Yeah. The 2000s were intense. And you know, we had another case in 2006 that dealt with school vouchers. It was the Ruth Holmes versus Jeb Bush case, and you know, vouchers. I think we kind of forget today what a hot button issue vouchers were at that time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But we had oral arguments scheduled in that case, and that was another case where we ended up being surrounded by about 2,000 people. Our building was surrounded. Fortunately, it was a planned peaceful demonstration, and I already had met with the people who were planning the demonstration in advance. We had worked out the logistics of where they were going to scream and yell at us. And in exchange,
always good to plan that out.
always good to do that. We realized that there were going to be so many people here. There would be very limited space in our courtroom, which can only fit 164 people. So I worked out with the organizers in advance an agreement where if any of their people got in line to go to oral argument and a reporter showed up, they would swap out positions with the reporter. So I got the entire press corps into the oral arguments, wow. even though these demonstrators were camping out in front of our building starting in the wee hours.
Well, you started your position in 1987. You held it for some 35 years, just retiring less than a month after we're talking to you now, February of 2022. From the courts to the media, how did you see the media go through its greatest changes during that long period?
Well, obviously, you know, of course, I was really involved in the World Wide Web from the very mm-hmm. beginning, so I got a chance to see this entire process. The World Wide Web, when it came along, was a serious threat to the business model of news organizations worldwide.
Sure.
I don't think the news media caught on to that soon enough.
No. Mm-hmm.
We went for a long time, well past the time of Bush v. Gore, when the news organizations were still operating pretty much on status quo, even as their business model was eroding. Of course, I began to see the changes in the 2000s as newspaper and other budgets shrank, staff were laid off or cut back. Of course, this led to a much diminished press corps that was covering Florida Supreme Court issues. Of course, it was also during that time that social media began to become very prominent. And I actually began exploring social media very early on because I was having a lot of trouble getting the news organizations to cover stories that I really thought they needed to cover. I got permission from the court in 2009 to start using social media just as an experiment of a way of getting information directly to the public. Mm-hmm. Of course, in 2009, social media was still very new and hadn't yeah. caught on like it has today. It was a good thing that I did that because, as we moved into the 2010s, news organizations really were hurting and social media took off. And, today, using social media is one of the primary ways courts communicate with the public they serve. We had a real lesson with that with the pandemic. Because when the pandemic came along, there was really no chance of us getting news organizations to cover what was happening as we had to close courts statewide and shut down the entire jury system process in Florida. We relied almost entirely on Facebook and Twitter to get information out. And of course, the viral reach of social media, the fact that it's shared by groups who have common interests with you, like the Florida Bar, that enabled us to reach the public we serve very quickly, simply using social media, when the pandemic hit.
Before we wind this up, I know we've kind of gone along here, but can you talk briefly about how Florida is a little different in terms of our original law system was set up that actually had bits of the Spanish law system in it? And then also talk about the choosing of the Chief Justice. You and I were comparing notes on that before we started here.
Yeah, funny moments in Supreme Court history. Yeah, the Spanish law system was here in Florida before the United States came in. Spain had basically set up shop. They tried starting in 1559 in Pensacola, but 1565 they established the first permanent colony in St. Augustine. Spain and Spanish law ruled Florida for the next couple of centuries. The United States started to get a little antsy about Florida because, you know, there were a lot of runaway slaves that were finding their way down to the beaches and the tropics, and Spain wasn't too good about doing anything about it.
No, so they'd actually free them.
Exactly.
They promised to be Catholics. Yeah.
All they had to do was become Catholic and agree to take up your arms against the United States. So Andrew Jackson marched in and took over the state. And eventually, you know, there was a treaty that was signed with Spain called the Adams-Onis Treaty. And it had some provisions that required the United States and all of its successors, which includes the current state of Florida, to honor legal rights that had accrued under Spanish law. This primarily affected land, especially in areas that we call Spanish land grants. To this day, you can still see a few legal cases that come along where the issue of Spanish land grants and comes up. And you know, what right did the king exactly give to Juan Pedro back, you know, in the day when he deeded over this expensive piece of downtown Miami? The issue would come up, and we still have in the Supreme Court library a number of old Spanish law books that we have resorted to through the years to try to figure out what rights existed under Spanish law. So, you know, that's an issue that does come up, of course. With regard to, you know, other crazy moments in Florida Supreme Court practice and procedure, we went through several ways of choosing the Chief Justice over the years. There was a time when the legislature could actually choose the Chief Justice. It changed in a number of ways as the Constitution was changed. The Reconstruction Constitution that was passed in 1885 included a cryptic line saying that, basically the Chief Justice position would be chosen by chance.
Flipping a coin or something. Yeah.
Well, you know, exactly. Flip a Spanish doubloon, I guess. But the court thought it was undignified to actually use real games of chance, you know, like drawing cards or whatever. So they hit upon this really what they thought was a more dignified procedure, whereby, you know, the justices would go into the law library and they would pull a law book from the shelves, open it to a random page and stick their finger on the page that they had chosen. They were supposed to not look, of course. The Chief Justice would become would be the person who pointed his finger to a page that began with a letter that was closest to the letter Z in the alphabet. Only lawyers could come up with such a convoluted system.
And that was better than just drawing lots somehow, obviously skill-based or merit-based somehow.
Well, except there was somebody who thought up a way out around the system, right?
Right, exactly. When I was working with the court, I've worked with our historical society many occasions, and of course with the historians who worked with them. And one of them told me that, you know, that there was a grumbling back in the day that a Chief Justice had snuck into the library and tabbed a book so that he knew exactly which page had started with the letter Y. You know, Z's are kind of hard to come by.
Yeah.
But Y's are more common. And so, you know, there was some concern about
that he'd rig the system. Yeah,
he'd rig the system, and eventually there was a constitutional amendment that was passed that changed it to the current system, whereby the seven elect the Chief Justice.
Craig Waters has been our guest. Really fascinating and enjoyable conversation. Thank you for your hard work for the state of Florida, and enjoy retirement.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Craig.
What do you remember about Bush v. Gore and the legal proceedings which followed it, Craig?
Well, I just remember that I think every reporter on staff got sucked into it somehow. And it was both exciting and also a real pain in the butt, because, you know, if you were working on something else you thought was important, forget it, because you're going to be working on this.
Yeah.
And it just went on and on and on and on.
it did in a day and age when, again, it was pre 9/11. It was early internet, and we just were not used to stories dragging out like this in real time, where you could have
elections anyway,
rulings with and right. It was a presidential election. In no one's lifetime had a presidential election gone that way. And I was working in news radio in Birmingham, and I just remember how every single day there was another twist or turn, and it was no, Al Gore was going to be president. No, George Bush was going to be, and rulings were coming down constantly, and we were, you know, tapping into our CBS network feed for and probably listening to Craig give the announcements, and it was you know, I just remember how it was more akin to a soap opera or a football game with lead changes, and that was a really good series, but then they punted in a field goal. And it's hard to imagine that time of where everyone was coming from into that story, which was so unusual.
Well, I argued in O Florida, in my book O Florida, that one of the figures from that time, Catherine Harris, led to the current attitude of Florida is full of Florida men and Florida women who are constantly doing wacky, weird, wild stuff.
Yeah.
Because she was the Secretary of State. She was in charge of the election proceedings, but she didn't realize that's what the Secretary of State does when she ran for the office. She thought she would be more like the U.S. Secretary of State and deal with foreign countries.
Well, I think
so. She had no idea how the law worked.
Right. I think that's a wonderful thesis and true in a lot of respects, where Florida's reputation as the state of weird and unusual and bizarre was really hatched in 2002 in Bush v. Gore. And welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.